Wait, okay. It's great to be here, and thank you so much, Len, for organizing this. I'm going to go very rapidly through a lot of slides. It's sort of a chronic disease I have, I think. But hopefully it won't overwhelm you. But the reason I do this is because this area is so vast, and I guess I've been doing it for a long time. So what I really want to do by this presentation is just give you a sort of a taste or a little bit of a window into the range of opportunities and challenges for health professionals who are engaged in primarily in doing human rights work in the midst of conflict, but also post-conflict. And let's see, what am I clicking here? Nothing to disclose. Okay, so those of you who don't know Physicians for Human Rights, we're a national organization. We mobilize the skills and influence of health professionals. Our primary work involves conducting investigations, exposing the information that we gather, which I'll be showing you a little bit of, and then advocating for change. But also we're very interested in educating, and so I'm delighted that we'll be followed by a session on, or a presentation on education. So what is the purpose of this kind of documentation and advocacy? First of all, our goal is to shine a spotlight on things that otherwise would not be known, and also to counter other narratives by perpetrators, in fact, that run counter to what the truth is. We use this information to mobilize pressure, to call for a cessation of conflict in some cases, certainly a cessation of atrocities. A lot of our work actually is intended to mobilize and galvanize appropriate humanitarian response in the midst of a crisis or post-conflict. A big piece of our work, as Len mentioned, is to ensure justice in various forms, in what we're now calling comprehensive justice, and as well as to enforce international law that should protect civilians as well as we'll hear later, health professionals. So over the years, I've started to think about the kind of work that health professionals can do in the midst of armed conflict in a human rights capacity as looking at some of the more obvious effects of conflict that we hear about in the media, in the acute phases, and that go into, you know, war crimes prosecutions, injury, deliberate violence, including sexual assault, torture, and so forth, and also mass killing. We've looked at all of these issues. I'm going to give you some examples. But more as interesting and as important, and this has been borne out now in work that PHR and other organizations have done in the last decade, is documentation of the indirect effects. And this is where public health professionals can be especially important in looking at what happens to populations who are massively displaced, what happens to refugees who remain in camps sometimes for decades after their flight from in the middle of a conflict, what are the differences between the services provided by UN agencies to those who are internally displaced within their countries versus those who are forced to cross borders and get a different kind of help in some situations and are acknowledged as refugees. What kinds of diseases are exacerbated or even enter into a population as a result of displacement by war, forced displacement very often with intent to harm. What kind of access to care do we have in the middle of conflicts? How is that affected by politics, by the global humanitarian response, by donors? What happens to health professionals and health facilities in the midst of these conflicts, and how do we document that in a way that enables those who have the right to care and the obligation to provide care neutrally in the midst of conflicts? And then, of course, there is also the effect of displacement on hunger, on the right to food, and on even the right to shelter, where many people can die as a result of sheer exposure to wind, sun, heat, cold, etc. And we are documenting all of these effects as well as the impact of war crimes. And that's really important to do. It's sort of a new idea even for the international legal framework. So that's where health professionals' voices and skills can be really powerful. The unique role of health professionals in this work, gathering the scientific evidence, and I'm not going to read all this, but these are the obvious elements and power, really, that health professionals bring to this field. The ways that research can be carried out are varied and increasing, and we've learned a lot over the last two decades about how to do this in better, more ethically, more efficiently, more effectively. But obviously, there's the most basic evaluation that can be conducted, population-based surveys, looking at records, forensics, and as well as qualitative research. We have done a lot of work on all of these issues using population-based surveys, and the power of the data over a population basis is very interesting compared to what was done decades earlier, just looking at individual cases or examining a single victim or a handful of victims. These are some of the places where we've worked. This is Macedonia, Kosovo War, population-based assessment of war crimes there. This is my former boss, Len, doing a population-based assessment in Chechnya, a really ignored conflict even today in terms of what's happening and what's happened there. And we have a lot of dilemmas, and that's what I was asked to speak about. So I'm going to just put them out there, and I don't have all the answers, but I'm going to raise some of the questions as I go through these slides for the next few minutes. When refugees or when people are assaulted inside their countries, and most of the information is within a border of the country where the violence is happening, do human rights researchers cross borders illegally even to get information if we think the information can save lives? Or is it best just to stay on the other side and interview the refugees, as we actually needed to do in the case of Chechnya? How valid is the information? How current is it when you're dealing with a population that has crossed? Are things worse for those who have stayed behind? How do you get mortality rates? How do you calibrate the risk that researchers take who aren't delivering humanitarian aid but who are gathering documentation and information? What happens to the health professionals from the local communities who are trying desperately to treat the sick and injured in conflicts? Looking at women and women's rights in armed conflict, we just saw the maternal mortality rate in Liberia. It's Afghanistan is one of the highest in the world. Again, partly due to the displacement due to conflict, partly due to the denial of basic women's rights in the country for many years, and partly due to the lack of health infrastructure, including emergency obstetric care and a lack of health professionals in the country. Again, here, how do you do research on a population such as, let's say, women under the Taliban in Afghanistan, when it might be dangerous for women to talk to an outside researcher at all, or when women are not really even allowed out of their homes? We had a very carefully crafted study that enabled us in a very sophisticated way to enter households with the permission actually of the Taliban and gain information about health, in which questions about women's rights were deeply embedded. But again, these are the risks that one that might be entailed in this kind of research. Again, researchers who do this kind of work, when you know that the government isn't necessarily going to look kindly on it, risk being kicked out. And that's why very often people who are doing humanitarian assistance are not doing this kind of documentation, because they would risk being kicked out. Looking at disease, this is the Kurds who fled poison gas attacks and ended up in southeastern eastern Turkey in the late 1980s, a huge refugee disaster, unpredicted at the time, very sudden. And as you can see, those of you who are in public health or anyone who has, any lay person would see the huge humanitarian disaster here. But at the same time, we were interested in looking at the injuries from the poison gas. So our dilemma here, in this particular instance, was what is the priority? Do doctors going in to document war crimes, like the unprecedented use of poison gas in the late 20th century, gather that evidence, or do we just drop everything and look at the brewing humanitarian disaster, where the under 5 mortality rate in this particular refugee crisis was 90%, diarrheal illness was 90%. And there, even the health professionals doing documentation have a dilemma as to what they should be looking at. Here's another example, Iraq prior to the war, looking at the vulnerability of a health system that was about to undergo an invasion. And a question here, another dilemma for human rights organizations or health professionals as academics or individuals, how are our data viewed by the public or the media or policymakers when some of us are taking very publicly visible positions in opposition to a war? And this is something that should be discussed further. Okay, thanks. I'm going to go, well, let's look at the hunger issue or humanitarian aid, another dilemma. When the delivery of aid supports war criminals, as happened in Goma, the massive exodus from the genocide in Rwanda, when basically war criminals took over running of the camp, or in many conflicts we see, such as in Darfur, for example, where huge amounts of humanitarian aid are just hijacked. What do humanitarian organizations do? Do they tell human rights organizations so that we can then do this research and document it and make a lot of noise, enabling the humanitarians to stay? We've also seen now increasingly, and I think Len may be speaking about this a little more, the expulsion of health workers from countries where they're serving because they are just literally gathering medical data that's essential to their work about torture, rape, mass killing, and so forth. We're looking now also at, and it's a very important human rights issue, the inequitable delivery of aid in the aftermath of conflicts. And again, I think like the Liberia case in terms of donors and who is delivering the aid, you see certain populations getting a lot of assistance because it's a favorite population or it's a country on the list of what USAID or the State Department is funding or another EU. And other populations are denied. Or when the government says, well, you can go and deliver aid in this area, but not up there because we don't want you to see what's going on there. What do we do? I'm going to skip the laws. There's a lot of humanitarian law about this, and I think I will just give you some images because I only have a few minutes. And I really want to get at the end to some of the advocacy that health professionals can do. Documenting sexual violence has many dilemmas in the context of war, especially what kind of risk you're putting in front of survivors and how to deal with the survivors who really do want to tell their story, who really do want the world to know, but who may not understand the full risk of having their faces shown or their names known. War crimes in terms of the U.S. Current war on terror is a huge area for us. Doctors can be incredible immediate observers of a situation like a prison here, where a doctor was only able to go in for 5 minutes and was able to put out a report just based on sheer medical observation of the conditions of the prisoners, the sanitation, and so forth. This is an example of the forensic work that can be done, work documenting indiscriminate weapons, as many of you are familiar with the landmines campaign, where the medical data from hospital records especially and from examining victims and from looking at the medical consequences of landmines really helped spur, and this is, I'm getting to sort of the advocacy component, where data can really drive the change in law. Data about landmines and the voice of health professionals literally helped drive in 5 years a ban on this weapon. And they were an essential voice, as I say at the end here, the medical voice was just critical in terms of the power and evidence and conviction and objectivity of health professionals in looking at this. This is the Ottawa Treaty signing of the ban on landmines. These are just some other examples of some of the documentation that I've been describing, in this case documenting genocide. This work really does show, if you look at number 7, it's one of the articles of the Genocide Convention or one of the indicators of genocide in the law that shows how the conditions of life that are destroyed are also an element of the crimes. And most human rights organizations are looking at bombs and killing and machetes and death and injury resulting from direct violence. What we're also trying to show that a war, the crime of genocide is actually also about an assault on the very survival of a population. And We're very pleased that the International Criminal Court actually recognized this analysis, and our work is cited in 9 times in the warrant for the arrest of President Bashir. And finally, health professionals taking this data, taking this information, and bringing it to the corridors of power is amazing. We had these are 2 doctors here, Dr. Sandra Crosby and Dr. Lynn Pawarczyk, with our Washington director, John Bradshaw, in the office of Congressman Payne, who's the co-chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, talking about violence against women in Darfur and Chad, bringing this story to Washington, speaking at hearings, and enabling a global response in the corridors of power at the UN and the White House and in other, in this case also in African Union countries, bringing this medical data to change, to seek justice, and also, as important, to protect and prevent future crimes of these types. So thank you very much. We speak a lot to the media, and basically what we're putting out usually reports or gathering evidence, and the media are often very interested in the details of our data, how we gathered the information and what the numbers mean. But then because we're also an advocacy organization, we're using international law, international legal frameworks such as the Genocide Convention or the Geneva Conventions to say, this is what we've seen happen, and this is what is being violated, and then we're calling on governments to do all of the things that are required based on the response to those human rights and humanitarian laws. That's a good question. Yes, we have quite a few lawyers. Len, who was our director for 10 years, has a legal background as a lawyer. We have quite a few lawyers on our staff, and it's really actually one of the most interesting things about this field is that it is the nexus between health, medicine, science, and law. And so we need lawyers to help us with our analysis. Sometimes they're volunteers who might work at a law school, and other times they're in our midst. Yeah, there are roles and increasingly so as this work becomes more expansive. Dentists, for example, we have forensic dentists. Teeth are very important in looking at human remains. Also used to be until recently. Now we have much simpler ways, but for DNA, sometimes teeth are still useful for gathering mitochondrial DNA. But also nurses are incredibly important. We've done work on maternal mortality, gathering data, and nurses who have public health backgrounds. Our AIDS campaign was led by a nurse, Pat Doust, so absolutely. Even though we're called physicians, I'm not a doctor, and I'm at Physicians for Human Rights, but psychologists have also been incredibly important in the effort to document the role of psychologists in the torture regime by the United States, which we're also working on. Okay.
Aside from documenting what's happening, what is the role in terms of providing ongoing support? Because I'm assuming that maybe communities think when you come in that this is going to be
That's a really, really essential and important question. I mean, the question is, what is the role of ongoing report? You're coming in, you're documenting, and then you're leaving. What's happening to the population, and how are they supported? As I mentioned earlier, it's very difficult for those who are delivering care to also be documenting. Sometimes it's done, but it's rare and it's difficult, and it may be not even advisable. So what we often do is partner with or hand off or engage with both local health professionals who are from the community, as well as international organizations who are doing emergency response, and trying to make sure that the people that we've encountered and engaged with get assistance. It doesn't always work, and sometimes there are populations that it's too dangerous to go back. So what we can do is advocate sometimes from outside. Increasingly, though, we're training local researchers. So in Burma right now, we're training local health professionals all around the border so that we're giving them skills so that they can continue this work themselves.